Welcome to Anecdotal Anatomy, the weekly podcast that explores the nooks and crannies of living in a body. Sometimes it's the two of us having a casual conversation through the filter of that day's topic, and other times we have special guests who add their voices to the chat. We are yoga educators and body workers with decades of experience as practitioners and teachers. It is with reverence and joy that we choose to take these conversations off the mat and into the microphone.
Our aim is to understand the human experience through the stories our bodies hold and the stories they tell. Since having a body is the one thing we all have in common, it seems like a good place to start. We are your hosts. I am Teresa Tobin Macy.
And I'm Sherry Sadoff-Hank.
Join us on this journey of discovery as we sleuth our way to the connections of our individual tales to the collective experience of being alive.
Welcome back.
It's me, Jinx. You owe me beer.
Okay. Can it be a glass of wine?
It's got to be a Guinness, baby.
Oh, Guinness. Oh, my gosh. I even have a story about Guinness, believe it or not, now that you said it.
Hey, man, if you drink Guinness, you have a story about Guinness.
Yeah, my story about Guinness was I went on a pub tour with my mother and my sister in Ireland. And we go to the first bar and the guys that, you know, the bartender asks us what we want. And I'm wimping out. I'm not getting the Guinness. I'm like, oh, that's a really stout, dark beer. Mm. And so I tell him this story and he goes, I'm going to get you a Guinness. And by the end of the night, you're going to love Guinness. And I said, how do you know? And he said, because I'm going to put a shot of black currant in it. And it's going to change it a little bit to make it more palatable and to make it a little bit less stout. He goes, but as the night goes on, I guess he was assuming we were there to drink for a while. As the night goes on, I'll continue to lessen and lessen the black currant that I put in little and make it littler and littler until there's no black currant and you will be a Guinness fan forever. And too bad Guinness has gluten in it because now I can't drink it and I do love it.
Oh. Yeah, I'm not a huge beer drinker, but I've always loved Guinness because who doesn't love a milkshake that's a beer? And when I first met my husband, or when I first saw him, I should say, he was standing at the bar at a place called Nice Guy Eddie's in the East Village. I think it was off of West Broadway and on West Broadway. And or maybe not. Anyway, Nice Guy Eddie's. It's on Houston Street. Sorry. I saw him in his black leather jacket drinking a Guinness and thought he was the hottest thing on two legs. And he still is. But then when we started dating, we would go to these really just dive bars and drink Guinness. That was how we started our courtship.
Yeah, what a great story.
And then the word courtship brings me to the courtship of Eddie's father. Do you remember that show?
Oh, I remember that show.
Yeah. What I love.
Oh, see, once you open the toolbox to a story, that file cabinet in your head to a story, look at how many different places it can go. Yeah. And you met this amazing, handsome, wonderful man. And that kind of leads us into the theme of the story, I think, because sometimes when we meet those guys when we're younger and we meet those men, it's kind of that first separation from the feminine, from mom, right? Because she's going to look at that guy and, you know, sometimes the guy who picks us up for that date, when they meet mom and dad, are exactly the man of their dreams. Oh, I couldn't find somebody else better for my youngster to have their first date with. And other times it's like, oh, man, who did you bring up?
Well, I've run the gamut on that one. I mean, I dated for many, many years. I was single in New York City for many, many years. And I didn't meet my husband until I was 30. And so I had a lot of different separations from mama, who always encouraged it, though. She was never one to kind of hold on. She was, go fly. You know, she was a roots and wings woman. She was like, look, our job is to give you roots so that you have wings to fly. And I never, ever felt that feeling of, you know, grasping or gripping. I created a word, grisping. Because it was like gripping and grasping at the same time. And my mom was a natural yogi. She didn't practice or, you know, ascribe to any particular doctrine, but she was a natural yogi.
Mm. I was number five. My mom was well broken in by the time I came around to bringing people around. Yeah,
I was number four. I mean, I stopped at four, but still, I mean, I was also, my mom had cut her teeth on the first three and yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So that, you know, there's so many ways that we can look at both our feminine and masculine energies within the body. This isn't the first time that we are bridging the subject of the balance of our feminine and masculine energies. And now at different times throughout our life, we see one as maybe more dominant or not completely 50-50 yin and yang, half and half, but that we go through many transitions. And one of those transitions is kind of a separation from at different phases in life or coming into different seasons, that there is a separation. And sometimes that separation, and I think what we're talking about today, is the separation from that feminine energy. And, you know, I guess that's what, how we started with our riffing about talking about moms, you know, the, right. that very, very tangible and dominant feminine model that we've had. I mean, come on, the first separation from the feminine is the day we were born.
Yeah.
We were in our mother's womb for 9 months. And as we entered this world, we had our very first separation from the feminine as we were birthed and the cord was cut. And just like your mom said, right? I'll give you roots to give you wings. That's the first sign that, all right, I've given you roots. I've given you a great foundation to start. Now, this is my reminder that we both have to take that journey of being separate and being two different individuals.
And keeping in mind that we, as the storytellers of this particular episode, we are women of a certain age, you know, that we have a way of telling the story that will be different than a man of a certain age, of any age, because everyone experiences that cutting of the cord. Everyone experiences that separation. So how does that show up in men? I don't know. We would have to actually have a male guest in order to have that conversation in this context. And maybe we will. Like, I think that's a righteous thing to do. But to remember that, you know, we are honoring our story. And so often women, we've had to kind of fit into the paradigm set by men, you know, whether it was the hero's journey and then Maureen Murdoch came out and wrote the heroine's journey. So, you know, we've always had to kind of fit into a model that was created by men. So here we are offering a model that is female centric, but is not exclusive to women. So maybe men can take the opportunity to see themselves in this conversation. It's not just for women, but as we've been asked to put ourselves in a certain container for many, many years, many generations, what does it feel like for the male listeners to be hearing their story in the context of a more female centric narrative?
Yeah. And, you know, female context, but also feminine and male energies. And we can separate those as well, that we have, it's like a baking bread. You and I talked about baking bread. There's so much feminine put in, there's so much masculine put in, and, you know, we have a little bit of everything. So what does it look like to think about in terms of separation? And that's really what we're talking about, the separation from many different things, the separation from feminine, but also from the stories maybe of that have been passed down to us. We love to talk about stories and we're not going to wander too far from the stories, but, you know, what are the stories that our elder females shared with us and how did they look at different things? Mm-hmm. And I feel that we've had many different opportunities, and I don't know why, but this very first one just popped into my head. So I'm going to dive right in, which might not surprise people that we like to dive right in, of a separation or a lack of separation from an old story. So when I got pregnant with my first child, it was in the late 70s, and things started changing in childbirth in the late 70s. There was a big movement that came back around that time for natural childbirth. This is a time when there was talk about going back to a more natural way of feeding and breastfeeding versus formula feeding. you know, we go through these waves of what things look like. And I remember broaching the subject with my mom and my grandmother and my sisters about going through natural childbirth. And the story that came out about how crazy I must be to even consider the fact that I wasn't going to follow the same way everyone else did, that I wasn't wanting any of the medications, that I wanted to be present through the entire birth. And it was a time where I'm thinking, okay, I am listening. I want to hear your story. I want to hear your experiences, but I also really want to separate from that story and do this my own way and have my natural childbirth with my doula. I had a doula that came, where it's in the hospital. It was still the late 70s, but my doula was with me at my appointments with my physician. She was there for my childbirth. And I was able to make that another one of these separations from not the physical person, but the stories that are generational.
And since you brought up childbirth stories, and I'm sure every woman listening who has children has a story, you know, around their birth experience. I remember when I got pregnant with our first, and my sister-in-law, who I fucking love, I love my family. She was telling, they were among the first people we told. We were out at Martha's Vineyard, and I was out with my brother and his wife, and she was telling me the story. So I won't retell her whole story, because it's actually very funny. Tell you later, darling. But the way she described it was perfectly natural childbirth. I had the feeling of being in a fairy tale. I felt like Snow White. She's telling the story and I'm imagining the woodland creatures padding up to the window and rubbing their little wet noses against the glass and peering in at this beautiful miracle that is happening. And that's what I wanted. In that moment, I created my birth plan. And it was going to be with a midwife. It was going to be the whole, you know, experience natural. Even though that scared the shit out of me, I was going to do it anyway because I needed to, like, this just became my thing. And at about 38 weeks, we discovered that Cassidy was breech. She was turned around. It was more like her butt was lodged in my pelvis and her feet were up. So she was more in like a V in my pelvis. And we didn't know exactly that. We just knew that she was breech. And so I did the version where they come in and they turn, they try to give. So here's the story. The nurse comes in and says, I'm going to give you some medication that's going to relax your uterus, but it's going to make you feel like you've had 30 cups of coffee. And I'm like, how the fuck is that fair? In 38 weeks, give me something at least that's going to take the edge off. No, you know, So it was extremely uncomfortable. Every time they would turn her and get her to about 15 minutes, she would just flip back up. I tried moxibustion, which is an acupuncture technique that has these herbs that my husband would burn, and he would burn the outer part of my pinky toe and put on some jazz music. It was a whole thing. That didn't work. She clearly was coming into the world on her own terms. But I had a choice to make. You know, I had attached to the story that I was going to have this perfectly beautiful, natural childbirth. But there's this possibility that the baby won't get enough oxygen if it takes too long to get her out. And honestly, that was not a risk I was willing to take. So I opted for a C-section. And in that moment, everything, I said, okay, I've released myself. I've detached myself from the story that I thought it was going to be. And I didn't know if I was going to be able to have more. This was, as long as I knew, this was the experience. And had a perfectly healthy baby, you know. But the other story was, my mother had told me that when she was doing natural childbirth-ish, she still had, she had an epidural. She had me naturally, but my sister, she didn't. So she had this epidural, or the spinal, they called it. And no one told her not to move. So at the end, they said, do you want to see your baby? And she got up and ended up with a spinal headache for 3 days. All the spinal fluid, whatever it was that happened, she wasn't supposed to move like that after. Anyway, that was the story I had in my head. So after I had the C-section and I'd had my spinal, I was like, oh, you know, can I move? If I move, will I have that crazy headache? And then they told me that the story of the needle gauge had changed. It was much thinner now. So no problems there. That was a detachment from the story. But then I got pregnant with my second child and I had to decide, do I go in for a C-section or do I, you know, and sort of follow that story? Because they say, once you have one, you really should. Blah, blah. But the reasons that I had the C-section weren't because of, you know, a labored labor or, you know, other things that would be life threatening. It was because she was breech. So I was in a prenatal yoga class and I made a decision that the first lesson that I was going to teach my female child was not going to be made out of fear. It was going to be made out of discernment. It was going to be made out of courage. So I thought the hospital that I'm going to has does allow for emergency C-sections. So I went in and I had it. I had my second two children, VBAC, and it was great. It was all the experiences were painful. They all were challenging, but they all were different. They were all made individually without the cord. I cut the cord with each one of those kids in terms of their birth stories. They were unique to them. But that was a separation from the generation before me. And even from my own, from the story I was told, I had to change that.
Yeah. This, I find it so interesting because we keep talking about the separation when the overarching theme is the quest for wholeness. And, you know, so we're looking at these ways that we have separation stories in our life, and specifically separation from the feminine. I think that's what led us down the path of talking about mom and birth. And, you know, we did also say that, hey guys, you know, maybe let's find the ways that you can relate to this story. And maybe it's just, you know, your cord was cut the day you were born, just like the rest of us. And when Dad used to say, I put my pants on one leg at a time, just like everybody else. But, you know, we have these generational stories. And I forget where I heard it, but I did, is that generational stories last for seven generations. And sometimes these are just the things that we notice, the things that are passed down both as verbal stories and just things that we notice. And there comes a time in each one of our lives that we have to decide if what we're remembering, if that event, if that decision is one that is out of habit, or if we still agree with these different stories that are informing our life. Sometimes there's just the generational story. You told the story about cutting off the ends of the meat because, you know, that's the way the grandmother did it. My mom did it. My grandmother did it. I do it. And finally, when you ask grandma, she's like, yeah, my pan wasn't big enough to fit the whole thing in, right? But yet the story went down and down and down in generations to cut the ends off for some unknown reason. And so what are those stories of this need to separate from the feminine in different ways? Or not even the need, but the times when we separate from feminine energy. And I think there's many life transitions where we leave one part of our life behind and we move on to whatever the next one. And for females and males, that's the cutting of the cord. We could also look at, you know, the day that we first come out of mom's all-day care, whether that is as a baby and you're going to grandma's or a different caretaker's while mom goes off to work. Or maybe if you were grown up in a generation like I did when my mom was a stay-at-home mom, the day that I had to go to kindergarten and mom, you know, held my hand and walked me up to the door, scared to death that I was leaving mom and having to go off into this strange environment that I was never in, that separation, you know. So when I first read separation from the feminine, it sounded almost like a negative thing, like, oh, I got to get away from that. But then when I really started researching and thinking and talking about it, it's a natural occurrence in life. And I think because moms tend to be, in most cases, or a mom-like figure, has such a predominant role in our early life and our early development, there's all of these different times where separation, like going to that first day of kindergarten, may have felt scary and overwhelming, and I wanted to cry, and lots of kids did cry because mom wasn't there and she wasn't coming to school with them. That was a necessary step to be able to move into that next phase of life, to go through a transition from early childhood to, oh, now we're in school.
And so it goes back to the neighborhood, it goes back to the fascia, it goes back to the things that separate us and are sometimes the same things that provide the fabric for wholeness. And so whatever wholeness means, because wholeness in some ways, I think, implies completion. And I don't know that we're ever complete. I think we talk about these journey stories and that we are journeying to tap into something of a universal truth or particular truth or particular feeling of wholeness, which requires that we also, I think, feel the fullness of self, the fullness of our individual unique expression in the world that is informed by our feminine and masculine energies. It's informed by the people and experiences in our lives, but that is the thing that writes our story. That is the thing that is like, if we look at the fascia as the blank sheet of paper that we get to write our stories on, that there's going to be the voice that is our individual voice that connects us to this bigger thing. So the separation is everything. It is both, it and both, everything, both binary, there's all the different choices, but it is the physical cutting of the cord where we are actually separated from our mothers. There is the physical separation where we are. I remember when my oldest, and I don't know why I keep going back to the oldest stories, but she was in a gymnastics class when she was very little at a local gym. And she cried every time I would have to give her away. She would be in my arms clinging to me. And the gymnastics teacher, who I'm still friends with on Facebook, who I love, she would have to extricate her from my arms, physically remove her from me to take her into the class. And I remember one time she said to me, "Mommy, aren't you sad that I'm so sad?" And I said, "Honestly, no." I said, "You know what would make me sad is if you went through your entire childhood and didn't do anything interesting or fun because you were a little scared. Like, that would make me sad." And so, you know, that's a story that she's heard me tell that is a generational story, is one that I don't know how she'll be able to draw the threads from that into some of her, how she's become. She's definitely not that today. I can tell you the story of when she stopped clinging to me. When I went to her school, elementary school, they had this field day. And I get there, I see her running and doing her games, and I'm with all the other parents in the back, and I find out where she is. She sees me. As soon as she sees me, she stays right at my feet. She's not leaving. She's clinging to me. And I said, "Honey, go back in there and play the games. I'm here. I'm watching." But she would not leave my side. Then they called for lunch, and I went over to her teacher and I said, "Okay, I'm in a conundrum here. What do I do? Do I stay and have her cling to me the whole entire time and make her miserable? Or do I leave? Or do I just not ever show up at these and have her have memories of mom never showing up?" She said to me, "You came, now go home." So I left. And at the end of the day, I asked her, I said, "Honey, you know, I'm just curious, just purely out of curiosity, which part of your day was more fun, the first part of the day or the second part of the day?" And she said, "Oh, the second part of the day." I had my answer right there. I don't have to go, because she had so much more fun when I was not there. But the interesting thing was, that was the moment she stopped being clingy. That was the moment she found her own authority and started to, so I could show up. She no longer clung to me. So there was that discerning moment, that absolute moment where I can pinpoint, and I can pinpoint it in my own childhood too, when I stopped being shy, but I'm not going to do that. It was a mother-related thing. But so then there's the energetic distancing or cutting off of stories that, and I'll go in a little bit later about some of my mom's stories, that I had to activate some of my male energy. And I have a lot of male energy in me, but I had to activate some of that male energy in order to cut that other cord.
Yeah, when we talk about the male energy, the female energy, the separation from the feminine, it's kind of fragmented. We look at it and say there's a separation. And I think that that's, you know, kind of the story arc that we're looking at, is sometimes a separation is needed to step back, to get that clearer view, to have the different experiences like you're talking about with your daughter. Okay, you had half of the day while I was there, half of the day I wasn't. There was a togetherness. There was a separation of mom and daughter. And there's also times, I know for me, where I feel like I have a lot of masculine energy. I have a lot of my dad in me. And it's balanced with a lot of my mom, and then brought together with how all of that becomes Teresa and who I am. So, you know, there's little bits and pieces of what all comes together, but it doesn't have to be mom and dad. I had my grandmothers lived in our home at different times. have six sisters and two brothers. You can imagine with that many children in a household that sometimes my older sisters were in a mom sort of a role because there was just a lot of kids to take care of. So, you know, I don't want to limit the discussion of feminine to mom. There's just lots of feminine activities or feminine energy.
And feminine doesn't have to be woman either, like sister's energy. Like, I mean, I know my dad and brother have female energy. We all have both. You know, I mean, they're also very masculine, but there's the feminine energy is entwined in the language we use and the way we show up and the way we, if the compassionate sort of empathetic energy. My dad was the most empathetic person I ever knew. And that I ascribe as a female energy, but I may be making that shit up too.
I don't know. It seems like if somebody wants to draw a line, they always have qualities on both sides of the lines, whether they're true or not, that they go from one direction to the other. But, you know, the recognizing that sometimes there needs to be a separation from, maybe it's, we're using the word feminine, but maybe it's just a separation from the known into the unknown. That is what we're really talking about, the willingness to take that step, to take that journey and saying, and so we can look at that in so many different ways, the willingness to take the journey. And that journey of separation might be, it's time for me to go off to college. And there's a separation of what I know, what I understand, where I feel comfortable and nurtured and nourished. And now it's time to go off into the unknown or switching a job. There's just so many different ways where we can look back at, I can look back at my life and say, here are the different times that I can look at where I've had a significant separation in my life. And I attribute separation to a feminine quality because I also look at it as sometimes the reason that there was a separation was because there's an uncomfortableness in a situation that I need to step away from. And sometimes it's a growth. It's a choice, like going off to college. It's a choice, getting married and leaving the home. It's a choice. But there's still that separation, that step back from what is known and the willingness to step into something else. Yeah. And that journey has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Mm-hmm. It has a trajectory. And the first part is the stepping away from, and I do put that nurturing nourishment, that understanding of where I am, the cozy place that we're beginning at, or maybe it lost its coziness and we're moving, and is the separation from the feminine, the what we feel comfortable with.
But maybe we're also separating from a bad situation, one that is not nourishing or you know, a necessary. We can be attached to a relationship, a story that is not nurturing or nourishing or good for us at all, and not be able to leave it. There's an attachment there. You know, think about relationships that, you know, people have a hard time getting out of even when they know that that's important. So for me, I'm not sure that the separating itself can be put into a masculine or feminine box. But I think the way that we journey, the way that we move, the ways and means that we take our journeys. So I'm always telling the kids, it's never what you say, it's always how you say it. What we say doesn't have that thing. It's how we say it. So it's how we move through our lives. It's how we sort of decide what is what we're going to take with us and not. So for my mom, and I'm going back to my mom energy because these are the stories. She was a huge University of Michigan fanatic. We learned Hail to the Victors Valiant before we learned the lullaby in my house. My sister, my oldest sister, went to Michigan. My niece went there also for medical school. Like, so we've had some representation, but I was a theater major. I auditioned there for their musical theater program, but I don't have that gift. That's singing and dancing I can do if I have to, but it's not what I do great. But I did that for her. I didn't get in. I didn't have the academics. Another thing that I rebelled against was the academics. But I remember I got into NYU on academic probation at Tisch at the theater school. So I think I had some talent if I was able to do that. But I remember coming home from vacation at one point for the holidays. I got home and I saw on my mother's desk, there was an application to be a visiting student at the University of Michigan, and it had my name on it. And I said, Mom, why do you have this application on your desk that has my name on it? She said, oh, well, Sherry, you know, when I've spoken to you in the last, you know, whatever, you've just sounded a little sad or you've sounded this. And I'm thinking, I just moved away. I'm living in a city for the first time on my own. There's going to be some sadness, some growing pains. But for each one of those conversations that I choose to have with my mama, there are 100 others that don't have that I'm looking elsewhere to kind of validate the good times, the fun things. But she got the sadness because she was my mommy. I wanted to, you know, but I said to her in that moment that changing locations was not going to be the thing that changed my emotional state. You know, I'm away for the first time. Wherever I go, I'm taking the sadness with me. But the fact that she was still holding on to this U of M story for me that I was never really a part of. It was not my energy. It was her story that I had to tell her, I'm not interested. That is something you wanted. She never actually even went there. She went to Michigan State and then University of Minnesota. But so, you know, she had a great education, but she wanted that for all of us. And I had to say, not my story, not my story. And that was a big one for her, I think. And, you know, now it's not a big story at all. So how do we live fully without attaching to our stories? You also mentioned that it's not just separating from the feminine, but it's separating from the familiarity. You know, I think to get caught in the masculine and feminine energies, that's just sort of a landmark. It's something to say, yes, there's feminine energy that we have to separate from. But the bigger story is the separation. It's the moving on. It's the cutting of the cords. So cutting of the cord of a story that has been passed down that was really important to my mother, but was not important to me, that's an energetic severing of the cord, you know, of saying, I'm stopping that story with me and I will not pass that on to my children. You know, Cassidy applied to the University of Michigan, but I was not going to make her feel like that had to be the place that she had to put on the top of her list. So it was just in honor of her grandmother and in honor of that story, you know, she did apply, but it took on a whole different feeling because I changed the story.
Yeah. Yeah. You gave her the option of, yes, see what you do, pick out the places that you want to go. And, but I'm not putting pressure. This is exactly your choice. This is your decision. And let's see how we can support you in the making of, in the collecting of data to make a quality choice.
And because you said it too, you said that the female energy is so strong, and it is a strong energy, which makes it sometimes difficult to confront. It's a difficult energy to, at least I will speak for myself. I had a hard time not disagreeing with my mother. We had a lot of disagreements, but I held her stories in high regard. I thought the things that she said had value and meaning. And so in order for me to decide to no longer share that energy, it was big, you know, because it was so much a part of my growing up. It was so much a part of the zeitgeist of my family.
All of us have these lineages of stories that have been passed down from generation to generation, from moms to daughters to granddaughters, and moms to sons, and what their relationships are and how those stories influence from the generation, regardless of masculine and feminine, in a search for the ability to have non-attachment, the ability to look at what's in front of us and still make a quality decision, whether we are acting with intention or out of habit and pattern. If we are passing our own neuroses down, either intentionally, our own story down, our own thing down, or by our actions. For instance, I read about a mom who was really, really afraid of the water. She was scared to death of the water, and she wanted to break that generational story. She did not want her children afraid of the water, so she took them to the beach and she took them to the lake, and she was working really hard to sever that generational story that water is scary and not let her own fears get passed down to her children. However, what she could not hide was that nonverbal communication. She couldn't hide her reaction of, you know, being a little bit, ugh, when the kids got too close to the water, that there would be this reaction that she would have. Or they would play in the ocean and the waves as they were coming in. But if they took too many steps out there, mom was like, come in closer, come in closer. Or, hey, mom, come in and play with us. But no, I'll just keep my feet wet here at the edge of the water, but stay close. So in a way, her body language and very just motherly, nurturing conversation communicated that even though she was trying to separate and end that story, the way she approached her children when they were around water gave them this feeling or this sense of not being comfortable there. Maybe not fear, but not being comfortable. And this is told from the daughter. And so I was so afraid of going out and riding in the waves and playing because you have to stay close to the shore. Mm-hmm. And even in her journey of trying to say, I recognize that this is something that is mine and I don't want it to go down, it feels to me like it still wasn't completely processed. So her body language and the way she interacted communicated a story she didn't tell specifically.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny because even when you do, like my mom was very clear, she smoked cigarettes when she was younger. The Surgeon General came out and said there might be a link to cancer. There wasn't even conclusive yet. There might be. She quit that day. She used to say she was the kind of smoker who would have a cigarette in the ashtray while she was brushing her teeth, you know, that kind of thing. So, but in my head, that was implicit permission to smoke. She could quit easily. Like, why can't I? So, you know, when I was given the opportunity to smoke, I took it. And I smoked for many years. And honestly, I did not want to tell my children that. There were other things I wanted to wait. At one point, one of my kids asked me, we were on a trip down south and they were really little. They're like, Mommy, did you ever smoke? Because a lot of people were smoking down there. And I said, here's the deal. I said, A, I'll never lie to you. I said, B, there's a time and place for every story. And now is not the time or the place. When you are 21 and you are old enough to drink legally, we will sit down, have a glass of wine. You can ask me anything and I will tell you everything. And that is how I feel. But what happened was my kids are very mature and they sort of got past the danger points, I think, their teenage danger points, where they do now know that I smoked cigarettes. They do now know some of my other behaviors that I did. But I didn't want that to be the story they always knew so that they would always have that implicit permission. Because honestly, if I went back now knowing what I know now, like we talked about, I probably would not have picked up that first cigarette because now I'm like, ugh, like, why would I do that? But so the point was, I didn't want to give them that story, that permission, the same one that I had from my mom that did give me permission. And my mom was so anti-smoking after that, it was crazy. But these are some of it. She was also afraid of the water. But, you know, instead of just taking us to the water, she put our asses in swimming lessons. She wasn't even around when we got in the water because, but I remember being a kid and watching her take a swimming lesson at a neighbor's house, and it traumatized me. Because I'm watching my mother who could do everything. She was afraid of nothing. This woman had no fear and she was afraid of the water. And you could see she never actually learned to swim, even though I was there watching her try to learn. So all of these kinds of stories are interesting. And the other interesting thing about the masculine and feminine energies, this is part of like when I was looking through these journeys, is that the female energy is about self-worth and identity. The masculine energy is about external objectives. And so I found that really interesting in terms of yin yang, masculine and feminine, as we work with these, you know, binary choices, these dichotomous ideas, that there's that dot in each where we have each of those things, but the internal versus or including the external, you know, the women, the female energy, we're going in and deep, we're going into that yin, dark, you know, close place. Whereas the masculine energy is more external and objective driven.
So now that we've separated from the feminine in so many different ways, do you feel that that has brought us into being torn pieces, or is it a step towards the whole?
Here's my feeling about that. I think every time we get to a picture of wholeness, it is a piece in a bigger jigsaw puzzle of a bigger picture. And every time that picture is completed, that is just a bigger jigsaw puzzle piece in a bigger puzzle. I don't know that we ever achieve that fullness, that wholeness. I think all of our pieces have the potential to be whole in themselves. And so I get into the philosophical piece of like defining what is it to be whole. And so I get in my head this image of this huge jigsaw puzzle that every piece is a whole story of a bigger picture, of a bigger story. So I don't know if that answers the question, but that's, you know,
yeah.
I think
the separation is the missing piece in the puzzle for a little bit. It might be the one that's in that 5,000 piece jigsaw puzzle. And you know that that next piece is an end or a corner, but you still search and search and search through all of them because you need to find that piece to move on to whatever that next part of putting the puzzle together into whatever that whole picture is going to look like. I used to, when I was young, I spent a lot of time at a friend's house and her aunt loved doing jigsaw puzzles. And she, all of the placemats in the house were jigsaw puzzles that she then had laminated. And that's what we got to have as our placemat at the dinner. This reminder of the fragmentation of a whole. And I think that's what the jigsaw puzzle is that it gives us all of these little tiny pieces of who we are. And in the image, in that one particular photograph of that one particular jigsaw puzzle, she was able to finish it. But as soon as she finished it, she laminated it so none of the pieces would fall out again, so that it could remain that whole piece, that it's going to be this picture and it cannot change because now I have it glued together. But it's okay because I still have my jigsaw puzzle table out and there's a box of them sitting there. And this is the next one. The piecing together of the image of whatever captured her attention at that time, whether it was a landscape, a bunch of trees, or any other individual thing, she had a way of organizing. And I always wondered, she spent so much time with jigsaw puzzles, and I always wondered, you know, the focus that it took to be so committed to doing one after the other. If I wished that she was around so I could ask the motivation, like, was this your meditation, this single point of focus? Was this a mindfulness activity? Was this how you manage stress? Was this just a pure joyful thing that you just liked seeing all of the disjointed pieces come into something beautiful and fold? And what I think about it, when I think about her laminating them, was in terms of what I think about now in separation, is an attachment that now that it's done, I can't let this thing go. Like, I've completed that and I can't let it go. I'm attached to it. And that brings us back to separation. And sometimes it's really hard to take that first step of separation, whether it's the first step of leaving because your daughter was clinging to your leg, or the first step of, I'm not going to tell that story to my daughters because I want them to have the freedom to choose the place that's going to make them the happiest that they can be. And we have both sides, the stories we pass and the stories we sever.
Yeah. Seems like a striving for the illusion of permanence. You know, this idea that if I laminate it, that it will be what it is. You know, in my mind, the jigsaw puzzle is infinite. There is no completion of the puzzle. You know, each piece that feels it whole in and of itself is really just a piece in that bigger picture. And so there's no laminate, because there's no end to it. It's a constant until the end of our lives. You know, we're putting in pieces that create pictures. You know, they're memories. I have whole memories of being a camper at camp, or, you know, being in theater. And there was a beginning, middle, and an end to those stories. I mean, I was a camper at counselor at the camp we did, but I no longer pursue acting. So that time in my life had a beginning, a middle, and an end. You know, I know my parents aren't here anymore. So there's a beginning, middle, and an end to the physical relationship that we could have in this world. You know, there's certain things that have those, but the beginning, middle, and end of my acting life, of my life as my parents' child, each of those whole pictures fit into the bigger puzzle of my life, showing it's almost like a map, but the map is always being charted. You know, there is no end to it. So I think that when you talk about this woman who laminated these puzzles, I think that is a really incredible image of most people, of many people in this world who attach to the story, and I'm not saying that's why she did it, but the image of that, of of, oh, this is done. Now I can, you know, put the laminate on it and it's permanent. You know, that the work that we do is constantly reminding us of impermanence, of the fluidity of things, of, you know, the way we're moving through our lives and stories. And so I just think that's interesting. And I'm sure that there are times and pictures in my life where metaphorically I've laminated something or have, you know, sort of held on to this feeling of permanence. I'm not getting a story in my head right this minute, but who knows by the end.
I'm pretty good at latching on to things. The practice of impermanence is one that I think weaves its way through our entire life. There's impermanence and change. It's just a constant. It's always there. So even if we deny that it's there, it still is. We still have each moment that comes and goes, and there's an impermanence to that. There's a letting go. That last second is gone and it's not coming back. I can tell you a story about what I was doing in that moment, but the moment is gone. And our life has a continuous flow of people who enter and leave, whether they're family, friends, or acquaintances, or just the random stranger that for some reason you pass that random stranger. Like I once visited with a woman who does past life regressions. So, you know, if you've been listening and a listener for a long time, you know, my woo factor is exponentially growing. But this was back in the day when I had very little woo factor. So the idea that I was with somebody who did past life regressions and she was hypnotizing me is a story in itself that I chose to do this. But when I showed up for one of my appointments, she said to me, "Oh my God, it's for you." And I said, "What's for me?" And she said, "I was in the city and this complete stranger came up to me and said, I have something to tell you, but it has nothing to do with you. It's for somebody and you will know who that person is when you meet that person. And this is what you have to tell her. You have to tell her that if she is not so structured and so tied with everything having to be orderly, that her creativity will just burst out at the seams and it will just flow easily. So to let go of having to have things look orderly and just allow them to be creative in whatever way that is." And so there, a random stranger who entered the jigsaw puzzle of her life that touched the jigsaw puzzle of my life in one sentence on a street in a city. And she, for whatever reason, took that story and made it part of my life. So I don't know why I even remembered that, but apparently the story stayed.
Now you're getting me. I'm replaying the movie Defending Your Life in my head with Albert Brooks and Meryl Streep, where they have the past lives pavilion and they get to go and see who they were. And it's hysterical. It's so funny. But so the creativity of being able to, you know, interpret life, the meaning of life and what happens next, you know, and to be able to put that on film and have people, you know, that's another, just another way of telling the story, which I know is not our theme for today, but it, you know, it's a thing. But you had said something about separating, where we're talking about separating, leaving the familiar, but also you mentioned getting to know who we really are at our core. And so it seems to me that in order to achieve that knowledge, to be able to even touch the hem of that knowledge, we have to separate from the things that are familiar, because those are so far the pipelines that have been feeding us and nourishing us, information, stories, you know, the generational stuff, all of the things that we know until a certain point come from limited sources. And so in order, I've said this before, you know, I think that there's value to the guru mentality, you know, this sort of, you know, one teacher, one student getting to know each other well. But I also think that in order to practice discernment, we need a variety of voices. And one voice, you know, repeating the same things is not going to give us that opportunity, or we can take it in different ways. And so the same thing is true here, that when we separate from the voices, the limited voices and energies that have been nourishing us to this point, so that we can hear our own authentic voice a little bit clearer, so that we can understand how our reactions and our way of being in the world and showing up is unique to ourselves and still connected to our families, to the bigger communities, to the collective.
Yeah, that space that we need from separation to just be with self. You know, at first when we started talking about separating from, it felt negative to me. Mm-hmm. It felt like it's like, oh, I got to sever this thing. I got to move on. But separation sometimes feels like it's really, really hard to move. Like you had mentioned, from what's familiar, and you use the word familiar, nurturing, nourishing. These are all things that sound like, oh, why would I want to leave that spot, right? Which familiar isn't always those things, but often we can use all of those words, nurturing, nourishing, what we are accustomed to as a definition of what's familiar. And that leads me into, oh, why would I want to leave all that stuff? I already know what's going on here. I know how to show up here. But even just the separation from a 5-minute interaction with somebody, or separation from our day for the 20 minutes to sit and have that time and space to be with our own thoughts, if we're just in a sit spot and we're not in necessarily a mindfulness meditation where we're looking to not connect with the story and just to observe and notice our patterns of thinking, or whether we're in a sit spot where we're actually watching what's going on around us and wanting to get involved in those stories, it still speaks to what you just said, this time to find more of our own authentic voice, the time of separating from the plethora of things that we could put our attention on right at this very moment, and being willing to separate from all of those so you and I can have this conversation, so our listeners can separate from whatever it is that they're doing to listen to the conversation. And maybe that leads them off into their own thoughts and their own stories. But somehow separation always feels hard, when oftentimes when you really look at it, some separations are pretty simple. Some separations are just easy and natural and just the very logical next step of what we need to do on whatever this journey of life or an individual thing is going to be.
We don't judge separation as good or bad. We don't reduce it to any kind of value judgment. It's one of those facts. We separate, you know, but I think because that first separation, like you said, is the cutting of the cord, there's a violence inherent in that. There's a blade being taken to the one channel of nourishment that you've had for 9 months. There's the language around it. There's a certain, I think it lends itself well to adding a value judgment to it. But I don't know about you. I was ready to leave home by the time I left home. I was fucking ready. But I also knew that my parents would be there. You know, I wasn't completely separating from them. I was leaving home. There was a separation, but there was still connection. We can be separate and connected the way Fascia tells us. We can be wrapped in our own unique space while still being connected. So what we have to go back to, what is it to separate? What is it to leave? Especially when we have someplace to return. And we've talked about this in terms of meditation, the return, the returning to the breath, the returning. I think for those who don't feel they have a safe place to return, or that there is, the separation is more permanent, I'm using loose quotes because we just talked about permanence as being an illusion, but some separations have the feeling and expression of permanence that I've got, like, I know people who are estranged from family members, and I'm not going to, you know, be naming anyone, but that became permanent as certain members began to die. And like that started as a thing and they were just separate. And it was important that they separated. But when you were talking, it made me laugh because think about how hard of a time we have separating from the ending of the show. Like having to end the podcast is an impossible thing. I mean, it's often when you end, I'm just like, okay, I'm just going to not say anything. I'm just going to let it be done. Let it just be done. Let it be done, for God's sake. Just let it be done. But having that separation anxiety, you know, I have that sometimes if I've seen old friends I haven't seen in a long time. And even just, I was at a Shiva recently for a friend whose mom recently passed away. And there was this feeling of returning, emerging from this pandemic, coming into community, mourning the loss of a dear soul, but getting to hug my friends who I haven't hugged in so long. And I didn't want to leave. I did not want to fucking leave. There. Mm-hmm. I said
there.
It.
There. Right? Sometimes it's just not the right time for separation. And other times, the separation is final, like graduating. But as we talked about at the beginning, death is not always it's not always final, because we still speak the name. We still tell the stories.
Yeah.
You know, we still remember and return to whatever those times are that we share together. And maybe I remember after my dad had passed, the separation of losing a parent. I had lost my dad. He was young. And that separation of losing somebody so close, somebody who was so instrumental in my life and a very strong male influence in my life, was hard. It was, it felt very final. And I remember talking to my mom about like going and visiting at his grave, because she would go and put flowers and do different things. And I had a conversation with her. I said, Mom, it's really hard for me to go there. I don't know that I want to go there. And she said, well, everybody does this differently. How do you want to remember? And I said, I'd rather sit right here in his chair and feel his energy of the chair that he sat in this home where I visited with him. And that's where my connection is. And she says, well, then that's where you should visit. That's where it should be. And I can remember the day that I thought about my father. And instead of being sad that he was gone, I was laughing at a memory and a story and a time that we spent together. And I just started laughing out loud. And I was like, oh, that's what it means when they say time has the ability to heal, because the transition from the sadness, the letting go, or not letting go completely. There's always that little bit of sadness that, that life has a certain amount of years, and then those people are not here on a daily basis. But that the sadness was able to soften mm-hmm. into a joyful remembering of the time that we spent together is another way of separation, of letting go. And creating the space when the sadness comes in, that's great. But you and I, the other day in our planning meeting, I said, my dad isn't always here all the time, but he's been here for the past week or two because stories about him keep coming up. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I look at, yes, there's this separation and he's not here. However, the separation has a line that is very, very blurry, because sometimes the stories, the memories, the song, whatever it is that blurs the line of separation and brings you back into almost feeling like that situation is in the present moment, that you feel it inside, you think about it, it's such great detail in the story that he is right here. And that, I think, is a big part of the reunification from the separation to coming back home or reuniting.
I agree. And I think, though, that it's interesting, the story of grief is different for everyone. Like, as soon as my dad died, I've had many tears. My dad and I were very close. I was very close with my mom. And when he died, I looked up and I was like, I wonder where our relationship is going to go from here. Like, that was my first thought. And I didn't, both of my parents were sick, we had a long time to grieve. And so by the time they actually died, in their different times, I remember someone came up to me at one point after my dad and said, don't forget to grieve. Ugh, like, don't forget to grieve. How do you know? Just because my grief doesn't look like what you think grief should look like. I at one point I thought I had to say, look, I can't feel bad because I don't feel worse. Yeah, you have to feel what I feel in this moment. And I didn't, there were times, and even in the beginning, because my dad was sick, so we were with him, and it was so much sadder when he was alive and suffering. There was just that piece. And because I believe in spirit, and I have friends who can connect to the other side, like my woo factor is commensurate with my, you know, realistic factor. I don't see them as separate. My woo and my science, it's all energy. It's all in the same space. So I feel my parents. I talk to them all the time. Yes, I fucking miss them. And yes, there are times where the emotion wells up and I cry. But it doesn't feel like an endless pit of grief. And it never did. Mm-hmm. And so I was never interested in manufacturing a story for someone else's comfort. And so I think that's also a generational tale of what grief should look like. You know, how we should experience. And, you know, some people experience it in, you know, everyone does it differently. So fuck them. Fuck them if they can't take a joke. Thank you, Jeff Goldblum, from The Big Chill.
Good show, you know, and that, again, is a story of unification, right? A bunch of college students who went to school together.
University of Michigan. They went to Michigan. Go blue.
Go blue. They shared a big part of their life together, then separated and came back over a tragedy. And, you know, so separations are not oftentimes not permanent, but we never step in the same river twice. And I think that's our story here. We never step in the same river twice. We have separation. Some of it is hard. Some of it is just in its own natural time. But separation is a part of wholeness. And it creates the space for individuality without it being a way of separating us from the whole.
So I have a practice. It's a hard practice. It may be the hardest practice that I've ever offered on this podcast. And that is to find a thing, a book, a bauble, anything that you love so much and give it away. Find someone and give it away. I had a crystal that was one of my favorite crystals, and a boyfriend of mine from college was moving to San Francisco, and I gave it to him. And he just sent me a picture of it recently on Facebook to show me, you remember this? I used to get these fairy balls, which are these little things. I loved them so much. This necklace, it made that little tinkling sound. And every time I got one, I would see someone who needed it. I would just give it away. And these are things like this is a practice I've done over time. As soon as I felt like I would get too attached to a thing, I always had to give it away. And so if you find something that you've collected over the years, something that has a story, and it can't just be, oh, I feel good about giving this away. Find it, give it away. That's all. That is
give
all.
Give it away, man. Give it away. I have to say, in reference to that, you've given me some amazing things. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Both physical and energetic. So sometimes what we give away, you can't hold.
That's right. But give away something you can hold.
Yes. Well, all right. I sold everything. So I had a lot of practice in that. But yes. So what's next, Sherry?
Stay tuned. We are going. And, you know, next time we're going to talk a little bit more. We started with the feminine thing and the separation. And we're going to talk a little bit about how we also identify with the masculine energies and how important it is to not just acquire, but relate to the masculine energies in order to create allies, in order to grow in a world that encompasses both. So stay tuned.
Stay tuned, and we will see you soon.
Thank you for joining us today. If you like what you heard, please click the like and follow buttons and give us a 5-star rating wherever you listen. These ratings help our grassroots podcast to become more visible to more people, so we can include more stories. Written reviews are like stars on steroids. If you are so moved, please write a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts.
We are just getting started. So if there's something you'd like us to cover, please email us at anecdotalanatomy@gmail.com. Tell us your stories. We'd like to thank our editor, Judith George, Keith Kenny for our music, and Cindy Fatsis for our photos.